not yes. the non-technical level.
Yes.
Okay, shall we start? Welcome. I see some new faces. And do grab the lecture schedule out front if you want to have that. Next week, Ben Kies will be lecturing. On lecture I'm looking forward to hearing very much. It's basically on pop music, follow your heart or else. And the sort of the mandatory command of following your heart above all else in his survey of pop music. And then the Friday after that is the 3rd of July, just before the 4th of July, and I'll be lecturing basically on an important theme of what happened on the 4th of July, or what was written on the 4th, released on the 4th of July. Okay, tonight, Jesus' challenge to doubt. I'm basically going to reflect on this passage of out of John 6, because it's got so many interesting things in it. I'll shift to my outline, but I may shift back to that just to let you have a look at the passage again as we go along. Maybe you could prompt me if you feel like you want to have a look at the passage for a change, or the other way if you want to look at the outline. I want particularly to look at this passage because of a strange question that Jesus put to the 12, which was, do you also want to go away? He seems to be inviting them to doubt him or even to leave him, or giving them permission to leave him along with the others. This is at the end of John 6, and the chapter, the whole last half of the chapter, chronicles a bunch of people who've been his followers have had enough. They can't take it. They can't imagine keeping on following him, so they're off. And Jesus is asking, how about you? Do you want to go away also? And my title, Challenge to Doubt, is intentionally confusing, purposely ambiguous, because the question would be, is it saying that Jesus challenges their doubts so that he can just blast their doubts out of the water and preserve their pure faith? Or is he actually challenging them to doubt in ways that they might not have dared to do otherwise? I've worded ambiguously like that because I'm really wanting to lecture about both. That one of the best ways to remove doubt as a liability and as something dangerous is to plow into it head on and not try to maneuver around it or be too respectable to talk about it or whatever. So I want to say it both ways. The best defense against doubt is to let it speak, give it its voice, get it out of the shadows and out of the innuendos that it lives in. Look it in the face, and that will help us deal with it most effectively. So I'll be looking first at this as a question that Jesus asks. Do you also wish to go? Let me just remind you of what we're talking about here. Do you also wish to go away? And then the second part of the lecture, I'll be looking more at Peter's answer. Lord, to whom can we go? You have the words of eternal life. We've come to believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. So both of these things, those sides tie together. First will be more on doubt, and the second will be more, what is Peter saying about his faith? To start with the situation, the immediate background of the passage is Jesus has been saying all sorts of difficult stuff, both hard to understand and also hard to accept for those who do understand it. Those are two different things. You can get messed up by or be offended by Jesus because you don't have a clue what he's actually saying, and it seems abstract and wild and woolly and weird. Or you can understand what he's saying and just really dig in against it. I think it was Will Rogers said, what bothers me isn't what I can't understand about the Bible. What bothers me is what I do understand about the Bible. And fair enough. I mean, he's not alone there. I was not alone. Insofar as we can see their reasons, which we don't have a huge amount on in the text, they are not the standard ones of the Jewish establishment, which were accusing him of being a Sabbath breaker, because he heals people on the Sabbath, a blasphemer, he makes himself equal to God, the Son of God, or he's against Moses, overturning the writings of Moses. But more, they seem to be reacting against the teaching that he's giving right then and there. So they don't show signs of being sent from Jerusalem by the temple police to watch out for this guy, but they're just listening and they say, whoa, this is really too much. He claimed, for example, just in that chapter to be the bread of life, and he'd come down from heaven, and unless you eat of the flesh of the Son of Man and drink of his blood, you will have no life in you. And just before the passage we're looking at, he raised the issue of predestination, of all reliable ways to offend people, to talk about predestination. So there's all sorts of things that are there that could have triggered them. And the crowd's response is somewhat diverse, and it's hard to know, but you get the sense that he came down from heaven. Really? We grew up with this kid. He's just Joseph's son. We know him. He grew up just down the street. What's this noise about he came from heaven? A very understandable difficulty. It might have seemed weird, barbaric, a bit morbid, some of his language. I said, who can accept it? But in any case, many of them did not just doubt, they left. Or as it says, John puts it, they no longer walked with him. I like that. The literal Greek is, I think, much better word. They no longer walked with him. It's important that these people are called disciples. They were not of the 12, obviously, but nor were they just sort of religious tourists or curiosity seekers who happened by and wanted to hear him once or wanted to see a miracle or two or something like that out for an afternoon. They'd been trucking around after Jesus, following him for we don't know how long, but there seemed to be a certain level of commitment there. And they took off. So Jesus asks the 12, do you also wish to go away? Let me just say a word about what that didn't mean. I don't think that was Jesus pleading with them, as if he's saying, you're not going to leave me now too, are you? All these other people have left, and I'm alone, and I'm feeling lonely, and surely you won't leave me, will you? As if he's guilt-tripping them into discipleship, which is not what he was doing or ever did. You're the only ones left, this kind of thing. But nor was it just a throwaway question, making a kind of joke, which some commentators kind of suggest. Because everybody knew that, of course, the 12 would never leave him, and the joke being how unthinkable that would be, so the question is itself a joke because it was so unthinkable that the 12 would leave him. So I'm saying it's not a question whose only force was as a rhetorical question, where the answer was already completely assumed. What he did mean, the question raises the issue of doubt, leaving him, to whom they seem to be very committed. What do we mean by doubt? Let me just reflect a little bit about doubt and then get back to the passage. Doubt is not unbelief. Unbelief is a clear rejection of who God is or God's truth and what God has revealed. Doubt refers to what happens somewhere in the wide space between belief and unbelief. Doubt is a halfway position. It's a space where you're experiencing two voices. You're in two minds. You believe, but at the same time you hear another voice that's telling you that you're stupid to believe, that you're naive to believe, that nobody ever believes anymore in the modern world, or that you only believe for the sake of self-serving reasons, not because you really believe it's true, that you should abandon your faith as quickly as you can for the sake of your own honesty and psychological integrity, or several thousand other messages of unbelief that come through to all of us. I've heard, I don't know about thousands, but certainly hundreds of different messages in my own head. They come and negate, they try and refute, attack, lead you away from faith. But doubt is the midpoint between unbelief and belief. something of the way, and this may be a helpful, I find it a helpful analogy or comparison, in the way fear is at the midpoint between courage and cowardice. You have courage on one end of standing up to terrifying situations, cowardice on the other, running away with your tail between your legs. Fear is what you are in between, and which way are you going to go? The fearful person may not know yet whether he or she will go toward courage or cowardice. So also, doubt is in between. Doubt itself is not a disaster or a catastrophe. It's a universal human phenomenon, not just a Christian problem. Atheists doubt their atheism much of the time. Agnostics doubt their agnosticism. I have a friend who wrote, "When I was in college, I was agnostic. Now I'm not so sure." So even agnostics. We all doubt all sorts of things. How reliable is our, how pure is our drinking water? How moral is our foreign policy? Are we, do we have honest politicians in our local government or not? How much can I trust my friends? All those are doubts. Now, none of them are convictions necessarily that your drinking water is poisonous or your local politicians are sociopaths or something like this, but you're somewhere in the middle. So doubt can certainly be dangerous because it can settle into unbelief. And unbelief is very dangerous because it's unbelief. But it's especially, doubt is especially dangerous when we try to ignore it, when we deny it, when we generally put it under the respectability carpet. And it does not stay under the carpet, but it's very dangerous when we try and put it there and try and keep it there. If we do that, it becomes a huge dark cloud growing slowly into our consciousness and invading our consciousness. But if doubt is face down and honestly understood, it can lead to a much more solid faith. So getting back to Jesus' question, will you too also leave? He was in gently pushing them to think very seriously about why they're with him in the first place and why they're continuing with him. Push them press beyond their thinking and to think out, well, okay, where, what other options do I have? He was inviting them to think about, really implicitly, other rabbis, other religious options, other ways of looking at contemporary events and problems. And he was actually giving them permission to leave, just like all the people who had just left, who perhaps were still visible over the horizon, walking away. Peter's answer shows that he understood the question in exactly this way. He said, "Leave? To whom will we go?" So he immediately assessed where I can go, what is an open option to me, the realistic place to go, and says, "Wait a minute, no place I want to go." Jesus' question had prodded him to think quite quickly about other options that were there in a religiously pluralistic society. Less pluralistic right in Israel, but a very pluralistic world that we have in the New Testament. So pluralism, religious pluralism, is not a modern phenomenon. It's a phenomenon, it's recent in the sense of, because there used to be Christendom in Western Europe and North America, a sort of a Christian monopoly, more or less. But in the New Testament times, there was nothing remotely like a Christian monopoly. Christianity was a very, very small faith in the midst of whatever it was in, whether it be Judaism or the Greco-Roman world. So there were lots of options out there. Doubt can come at us from looking sideways. Imagine the 12 within a far larger group of people all following Jesus. The people started to leave and go home. They were offended at Jesus' teaching. Who can accept it, they said. Then more people still started to leave. They obviously didn't think Jesus was the Messiah or that Jesus was the solution to any particular problem they had in their minds and their agendas. When something like that happens, what is the likely impact on those who have stayed? It's worth, you've got to think psychologically what it feels like to have all sorts of faithful people behind a cause that you believe in, and let's say 3/4 of them or 7/8 of them leave. When we're surrounded by others who share our beliefs, not just religious beliefs, but other sorts of things too, political commitments, say, and our beliefs and convictions, we feel supported. If that support group gives up, takes off, and goes home, we're likely to feel exposed and our faith weakened, or our commitment, our conviction weakened, especially if we keep looking sideways at what all these other people are doing and what they're saying as this is going on. If we see our support group go home, we can easily think, oops, am I wrong? Am I all wrong? Are they smarter than I am? Have they seen things that I didn't see? I am apt to question my own convictions and commitments to know, am I right? Am I being just naive or stupid or whatever? What's happening? I suspect Jesus wanted to challenge them to recognize and go through their doubt that they could go out the other side. And it's right at this, what I point is, it's at this moment when everybody's abandoned them that Jesus is asking them this question. So they're in a place of psychologically weak, a place of weakness, and that probably a lot of their friends have taken off. Friends that they've known for many years, maybe loved to spend time with, have just left them. And Jesus is catching them at this time of weakness and putting this question to them when the issue of leaving is liable to have some traction to it. It's liable to have some leverage to it in their minds. And I think what he's after is that it's a wonderful thing and a necessary thing to know that your faith, if you're a Christian, is your own faith. It's not your parents' faith, it's not your pastor's faith, it's not your friend's faith or your group's faith, it's actually your own. People growing up in a Christian home almost invariably go through a time, if they carry on living as Christians, when their faith becomes their own in a way that it wasn't when they were 4 years old, 6 years old, even 10 years old. And Jesus is really trying to be sure their faith is their own. They needed, as we need, faith that is not propped up only by group support. Don't get me wrong, we need other people. Christian faith is not meant to be lived as lone rangers, each one with strength and standing and not needing anybody around. That's not at all the picture you get. We need other people, but our faith must be in God, not in the other people. We, especially at times, desperately need other people to support us when we're in trouble and we're in need of support. But if our whole faith is built around resting on the foundation of other people's faith and or enthusiasm or whatever, that's a problem. We need God, but we need also God's people. If we are unable to trust God, we will in a group be a taker rather than a giver. In other words, we'll get what we should be getting from God from the group itself. Dietrich Bonhoeffer's little book Life Together is brilliant on this, so showing to be. It's one of the better things there is on Christian community, but showing to be a right player in Christian community, you need also to have the internal strength to stand on your own hind legs, to actually be able to contribute and give rather than just be sucking up energy from everybody else in the community. This is a huge question, I think, for modern European and American, North American Christians. As I said, there used to be Christendom, a near-Christian monopoly, sort of. Now we're living in the midst of religious pluralism, where we live shoulder to shoulder with all sorts of people of other faiths and no faith. And we certainly do not have anything remotely like monopoly, sometimes a very pointed and powerful and sometimes painful minority position. But this is the kind of situation the Christian faith arose in. This isn't something new that's happened, that's sort of post-Enlightenment or whatever. Many of the forms of modern doubt spin out from this changed social status of the Christian faith. They happen especially when the content of our faith jars against the accepted wisdom of the majority of society. I'm not going to... It would be lots of lectures to develop that, but by which I'm not going to try to do tonight. but just to give examples of where biblical faith is dissonant to the general drift of our society, it can make all sorts of issues for us and difficulties for us. Just think of ideas of freedom, particularly say sexual freedom, or believing in religious truths, which could potentially exclude other people's religious truths, gets us into tremendous conflict with the main drift of the society we live in, or certainly in this part of the country anyway. We have to look sideways to see what other people are doing and thinking and saying, but in order to understand what's going on around us, but we can't be controlled by what we see when we look sideways. So, challenging doubt. I think Jesus was planting doubt in the 12, giving them a chance to think. As I've said, why did I follow Jesus in the first place? Why do I want to continue following Jesus? Is there any other option? Is there any other place I would turn? Because he wants them to be stronger and more self-aware of why they decided to follow him in the first place. He challenged them in this way at exactly the time when they would have felt abandoned, alone, and under stress. This interests me because here at LaBrie we have many students come through with serious doubts, others really in solid unbelief, and a good many not sure where they are, and nor are we sure about them where they are. What we often do here is to ask them to do an inventory of the issues that cause them doubt. I mean, as a starter, many people that we run across anyway have grown up in churches or Christian situations where doubt was not done. Doubt is a horrifying thing. Doubt makes people gasp and means you get prayed for in the next prayer meeting in ways that you really may not be happy about. You can go down that road as far as you want. Again, there's a sense of people backing off in horror. Oh, someone's doubting. I thought you were a solid Christian or something like this. And that's really destructive because we need the freedom to doubt. And so we want to work very hard to make that happen. So we try to encourage students here to listen to the voice of each doubt, let it speak in its most obnoxious tone of voice. Don't let it be polite, let it speak in its obnoxious, forceful, rude tone of voice, and write it down in a whole list of as many doubts as you can think of. And then, maybe in tutorials, we will try and unpack those and address them one at a time, because doubt usually comes to us as a black cloud. And if you ask someone why they're doubting, they may not even have any grip on what makes them doubt until they really stop and think and work it through and pray. Help me know. Help me find out where this is. And then give, which is just what many people spend their time trying to keep from happening, give doubt its voice. Let it rip. That's what you want to hear, is its real voice. And rather than trying to put it down and not hear its voice. Because if we do that, doubt is no longer living in some indefinable, dark, and paralyzing cloud. But specific issues can be grappled with and perhaps even resolved. Now, I'm not saying we can resolve anybody's doubt. We're certainly not silly enough to claim any such thing. But we want to encourage people to put them on the table. What chance have you got to resolve them unless they're on the table in their full anger? Or disintegrating voice. I remember fondly a woman who came just after lunch one day. This was several years ago, and no one of workers here had time to spend with her to sit her down and figure out what she wanted to study or whatever. So she wandered around the property and sat in the library until late in the afternoon, and I finally got to talk to her just before supper. And she told me that she had very serious doubts about her faith, but that she felt much better about it already. And I thought, really? Already? And thinking in my mind, I'm not saying out loud, she hasn't heard any of our brilliant lectures, or been in any of our serious discussions, or been managed by us at all in her doubt or anything. She just feels better? wow. And she said, yes, I knew when I had been in the house for a few minutes that this was a safe place to doubt. And that made all the difference to me in my even thinking about what's going on. I have no idea why. I mean, someone saw her, showed her to a room, was kind with her, and so on to her, and told her why no one could see her. I have no idea what happened. But somehow, she got that message, which I was just so grateful for, because that's certainly what we want to communicate. I mention that because what she experienced is just what Jesus assumed in our passage, that we need to be able to doubt. We need to be able to stop and ask, am I going to stick around or am I going to take off, leave with the rest of them? We need to ask that. We need to wrestle with that. We need to process that and know somehow why I decide what I decide about that. It's not that I'm not saying we need to doubt, but we need the freedom to doubt if we have to doubt. You see what I'm saying? I'm not saying there's great virtue in doubting. It's great if no one doubts at all. That's wonderful. Although I don't know many people who I believe who claim to never have doubted. Two people I do know who I do believe, but the others I don't. When doubting is denied, faith is held hostage. When it is allowed, faith has a chance to grow, at least. Peter's response here, to whom can we go? First of all, his choice. Peter realized that Jesus was pointing to a choice that he must make. Who knows how Peter formulated it in his mind or what any of them thought who listened to it. There were Pharisees, there were Sadducees, there were Essenes out in the country to the east. There were Zealots as a sort of an underground movement all over the place, who didn't really come out of hiding until for some years later. All these were parties we know about in first century Israel. Undoubtedly there are many more. He knew that if he chose one option, he would be closing the door on other options. I want you to think about that, because he had no idea of the predominant view that people have today, which might have led him to say something like this: I might as well follow you, Jesus, because you are doing some good things. And by following you, I'm not saying I'm right or that those who have left you are wrong. Those issues really don't matter, since no one really knows the truth about God anyway. Okay? So, this is what's hugely just across the board today in the public discussion of faith, and certainly in the academic world. No one really knows, so the commitments you do make are tentative and sort of halfway, and they're not really too important because you can always back up from them, and nobody really knows. So you mustn't think in terms of full commitment. This I would call this religious relativism. It's also things you could call it, but it's so common today that it's pretty much assumed in much public discourse about faith. I remember a famous speech given by a student at Harvard at graduation some years ago, where he said, I'll just give you a short piece of it. The freedom of our day is the freedom to devote ourselves to any values we please on the mere condition that we do not believe them to be true. Okay? Commit yourself to any values you please, but you're just not allowed to believe them, that they're true.
Was he being serious?
Yes, and critical.
Critical of that thought?
Yes.
Okay, so he wasn't accepting that thought?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
No, he's tackling it. And so he got people upset. I think these ideas are so basic and common that for many people they can function as kind of a default setting to our religious questions and wanderings. This is where you go because it's where everybody else is, so it must be a safe place. And this is what's reliable because it's everybody's. There's so many people there. So many voices are saying, especially that are learned voices, that it can function as kind of a default position. By that I mean that it's considered to be so deeply ingrained and widely held that it is self-evidently true. You don't need to have an argument that establishes its truth. It doesn't have a burden of proof. You can rest on it without investigating it seriously or needing some burden of proof. As a default worldview, religious relativism protects you from needing to really commit to anything. Every commitment can be tentative, and you're not really, if you commit to one thing, you're not, you're still open to change and commit to something else. Many people who turn from Christ today do not consider, or do not feel they have to consider, as Peter did, well, to whom can we go? In other words, if I don't follow Christ, who else am I going to follow? So they often don't think of going to anything, or anything to take the place of a Christian God that they may abandon in this highly relativistic world. So you have people being very, very critical of biblical faith, turning away from it, but being completely uncritical of what they're turning to. What are they putting in its place? They leave God, but what are they turning to? What are they embracing? What are they doing with their lives? What's working in its place? Many drift away from God, but just end up not with another better thought out faith, but with a very, very feeble attraction to Jesus, which somehow keeps a respectability or some sort of a psychological continuity going there. Because it's hard to sort of throw Jesus into the scrap heap entirely. But a Jesus is a Jesus who is not Lord. It seems safe because the default position is relativism and no one really knows what's true anyway. Peter's attitude is very different, speaking in a very different climate. If not Jesus, then whom? It's got to be someone else. He looks around at the options and comes right back to Jesus himself very quickly. I think I see a parallel between this and the great choice left at the end of Joshua's life as he's renewing the covenant at the end of Joshua chapter 24. He's renewing the covenant with the people. The covenant's being reaffirmed. This passage that is very, very familiar to many of you, Joshua 24, 14 and 15. Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the gods of that your ancestors served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. Now if you are unwilling to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your ancestors served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Now you see what he's doing there. He's saying, follow the Lord. But if you don't follow the Lord, don't just wander off and don't think about what you're doing. Make up your mind, who are you going to follow? And know that they have identities and consequences. And you're going to follow the gods of Egypt, who Yahweh freed you from slavery. The Amorites, in whose land you are now, that means God has led your people to defeat the Amorites. That's why you're living there right now. Or various other people that they've already defeated. You're calling first to faith, but then also to saying, look long and hard about whom you will serve, because you will be serving someone. That is the thing that is behind this interaction between Jesus and Peter. To whom will we go? Well, if it's not following Jesus, it will be following someone. If you're not serving God, you will be serving someone else. Know it or not, aware of it or not, conscious of it or not, you will be serving someone. And do yourself the favor of thinking through those alternatives carefully, naming what those alternatives are. This is all what Jesus was asking, to whom will you go? Or will you leave? And then Peter answering, where would we go? And then more Peter's positive response. He starts to explain his decision. Let me just go back and, give you the passage again. Do you also wish to go away? Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom will we go? Can we go? You have the words of eternal life. We have come to believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. Um, here is Peter. He said, where else could we go? That's negative. We have no other place to go. We want to go. But he shifts to the positive. Peter is saying, you're dealing with the really important issues of life and death, of eternal life, of eternal destiny. Nobody else is dealing with that in the same way. Nobody else has an answer to that. You have these words. Nobody else does. You're dealing with what is the kingdom of God? How can we be part of it? I feel the modernness of this evaluation. Here's Jesus, who Peter says alone is really dealing with the biggest issues that are out there, the most important issues that are really pressing on us. I think, say today, about look at contemporary pop psychology, psychological literature. It's flooded with literature, seminars, growth groups, dealing with anxiety, depression, stress, success, meaningfulness. All very good questions, all very important questions to deal with, but almost none of them address the bigger issues that stand over all those issues. Who in the world are you? What are you for? Is there any meaning to the whole of the human project? Is there a God there who might have purposes for you and that makes a difference? These are not even raised. And they can't be raised because in a secular culture, the answer that is available to all these questions is utterly bleak. It's utterly negative and without hope. And as a result, would aggravate anxiety, depression, and stress, not alleviate them. You see what I'm saying? Given the modern discussion, looking at the modern secular worldviews that are available out there will make it all worse. Will add to anxiety for sure. Depression, very probably. I think of something that was an event when I was in college. I went out to dinner with one of my roommates and his father. His father was a very, very successful business person in Boston. We went to Lockovers when that still existed. He gave us a wonderful meal. But the idea was to ask him, my roommate and I were seniors in college, we're just beginning among ourselves to really raise questions of meaning. None of us grew up in very religious homes or had much religious training. He didn't. He grew up in a quasi-Jewish background. I grew up in a not even quasi-Christian background. But the idea was to get together with his dad and ask him, what do you do with questions of meaning, the meaning of life? What have you done? What have you worked out? What have you decided? Brilliant man. Amazingly able man. And we talked around, and he said, put his hand on his son's shoulder, and he says, Dick, his son, my roommate's name was Dick too, what you need to do is to get a job that's really demanding and fulfilling to you, and then these questions won't bother you so much. And we thought, that means just join the rat race. Just shut down and join the rat race, and that's all. That's his answer. That was his answer. Just join the rat race. And so you can see that this is what Peter saw in his time. We're seeing all over the place today. The big question is nobody will touch them except Jesus. I love this line from T.S. Eliot, written after becoming a Christian, but having spent a lot of his life not a Christian. And looking back at a godless society, he says, and the wind shall say, here were decent, godless people, their only monument, the asphalt road, and 1,000 lost golf balls. An end point, a bookend to modern secular culture. Not that that's all there is in secular culture, but a bookend of what a great deal of what's going on. So Peter's baseline. He'd come, it says he'd come to believe and to know that you are the Holy One of God. We're moving on toward Peter's, more toward his positive grounding. It's not just we can't think of any place to go and who else has the words of eternal life. Oh, you do. But he says, I've come to believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. These two words, to believe and to know, are the two main just words that are used many times in the New Testament. but their meaning is actually quite close to each other. And so you can't draw a big distinction between them from the meanings of the Greek words themselves. We've come to believe, seems to refer to their conversion, the decision to follow Jesus in the first place, back in the beginning. I'm not sure how much before this, this is at least a year before. You can think of Peter as a fisherman, whose brother Andrew met Jesus first, and Andrew said, "We think we've found the Messiah." He drags Peter along, Andrew drags Peter along to meet Jesus. And Jesus, the minute he sees him, says, "You are Simon, the son of John. You are to be called Cephas." So he basically renames him on their first meeting. They all left their fishing business and whatever else they were doing. And the 12 had been following him ever since. By the time you hit this verse, they'd basically been called out of what they were doing and had been trucking around Palestine following Jesus. They seemed to believe from early on that he was the Messiah. Those we know as we go along, they had their view of the Messiah and he had his. And so this is a constant dialogue going along, but Jesus put up with them and brought them along, and they followed him with amazing faithfulness. As they followed him, they got to see some pretty amazing things. So I want you to, the contrast between we came to believe and now we know is, I think, a certain chronological thing. We came to believe, but now we're in a different place because we've seen quite a lot since we first believed. They saw some amazing things. Peter saw right away his mother-in-law healed. They saw Jesus change water to wine at the wedding in Cana. They saw Jesus walk on water. They saw him heal the man who'd been crippled for 38 years. They saw him multiply a small picnic to feed 5,000 people. And Peter would have been among the people going around picking up pieces of bread afterwards and getting 12 baskets full of food left over. So he's seen a lot since he first scrapped the fishing business or put it on the side and followed Jesus. He's seen quite a lot. After all that he and others have seen and experienced since their initial belief, they now know that Jesus is the Holy One of God. This knowing seems to be a knowing of confirmation of an earlier commitment. A confirmation of belief through experience over time. The New Testament many times it says that people have tried to figure out the relationship between believing and knowing, and one of the intriguing observations that the scholars don't quite know what to make of it, but that it says many times that Jesus knew God. It never says that Jesus believed in God. You know, it's not in question. He obviously believed in God. He was divine himself. But that word is not used of Jesus. But the word that he knew God is used many times. So it may be that a knowing God here refers to something closer relationally than believe. But to know is maybe more internal. But Peter and the others claim to know as well after their experience. What Peter seemed to claim is through this breadth of his experience. I'm just bringing this into today's situation because it strikes me. It's interesting to think of this distinction now. I've had occasion to think about it a number of times. I'll give you one example. I've been asked a couple of times by someone who's not a Christian and having no Christian commitment, but challenging me, saying to me, "You asked me to be open-minded to your Christian faith so that I might come to believe in Christ. But are you, looking to me, open-minded enough to be convinced by me to doubt or even discard the Christian faith?" You know, you see what I'm saying? Are you open-minded? You tell me I need to be open-minded to believe, to be able to perhaps receive Christ. But what about you? Are you open-minded? Or are you shut down and dug in and have nothing beyond any interaction? And I think it's a difficult question, but an interesting one that takes us back to the very thing that Peter is talking about, the distinction between believe and know, which is, I think, helpful. Because I want to be open-minded to any other worldview. I do want to be open-minded to any other worldview. because my first commitment is to believe what is true. In a sense, I want to say I have a commitment to truth before or above my commitment to God. Because my commitment to God is only because I believe God is true. My commitment to Christ is only because I believe Christ is true. And so that can only happen if you have a prior commitment to truth. For example, I don't believe in God because it just makes me feel good, or because it gives me friends, or any other reason like that. I believe it because I really believe it's true. But if you say your commitment is to what is true first, it means you've got to be at some level open to other claims of things to be true which are not Christian, and that maybe that conflict. All sorts of things are true but don't conflict with the Christian faith, but some do. My commitment is to truth, so I'm potentially at least open to hear and be convinced. But at the same time, I have to admit that I think it's very unlikely that I would be convinced of some entirely different truth, because, and here again, I'm putting myself back in the shoes of Peter here. I believed back in 1964 and 5, as a result of a lot of serious thinking and study and conversation with a lot of people, which involved conclusions both about implausible things to do with other beliefs, which I had as possible things, which had been very attractive to me. Existentialism was attractive. Eastern religion was attractive. I reached a place of being those. I found those to be very implausible to me eventually, after looking at them quite carefully, and also dealing with very found to be credible many aspects of the Christian faith that I felt were unattractive to me. So I worked through a lot of these things back in 1964 and 5. Then I spent the last 50 years-ish since then not holding on to that commitment with white knuckles and a closed mind, but actually trying to learn, study, work, live, and follow Jesus in a very imperfect way. But during that time, I've not learned nothing. 50 years as a Christian, I've not learned nothing. Okay? I think that's safe. I've actually learned something, grown a bit, about why I still believe, and believe much more, what I decided to believe back in 1965. And also more about why I do not believe what I do not believe that I discovered first back in 1965. Not that I've not changed views. I've changed views in all sorts of ways. But if someone presents me with a radical new idea that refutes biblical faith, I have to admit that I have trouble having a mind that is as open as a blank slate to say, okay, I can hear this with no previous assumptions whatsoever. For example, I think at least every 6 months you hear some Aramaic document that's been hidden in the Vatican Museum, and because of conspiracies within the Catholic Church, they keep this hidden because it tells that Jesus was just a fraud or something. And at least 6 months is one of the, there's someone coming up claiming something like this.
Every Easter.
Yeah, I think that's true. Just as the news magazines are coming out with Easter issues, that's a good point. It is. It's usually just before or around the time of Easter. But I mean, what can you do? What are we supposed to do? Drop everything and think that this is the final truth that refutes everything I've learned and thought and believed and built on for 50 years? I don't think so. I don't think that's honest. And I think it's okay, is what I'm saying, to say with Peter, I believed and now I know. A lot is just about why I believe this is true. It's not as if I'm beyond doubts or anything like this. I have doubts, but I can't help having a certain bias as I try to consider all these new supposed refutations of the Christian faith. So, just winding it up here. As we've looked at this passage in John 6, there have been two main themes. Closely connected, what you could call redemptive doubt, that is a doubt that leads back to faith, that is built really on honesty, that we've got to be honest about what we believe and why. And then the dynamics of belief and confidence in God as we live. How does this work over time? I'll end by giving an example of one of the most famous doubters in history, Doubting Thomas. Think of how Jesus deals with Thomas's doubt. Thomas had not been present in various places where Jesus, on Easter Sunday or the days after, where Jesus had appeared to the other disciples, the risen Jesus had. He couldn't take their word for it, that it was true, that Jesus really had risen, that they'd seen him. It was too outlandish, presumably too much of a wish fulfillment, too good to be true. Who knows what was going on in his tree? But he said, unless I see the mark of the nails on his hands and put my finger in the mark of the nails and my hand in his side, I will not believe. And then it says, a week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put them in my side. Do not doubt, but believe. Thomas answered him, my Lord and my God. And Jesus said to him, have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen, yet have come to believe. Now, the point I'm making here is Jesus is right on the same angle. He wants to confront doubt and look at it right in the face and help his people deal with it. And he doesn't skirt around Thomas's doubt. He doesn't avoid confrontation with Thomas. He says, here it is. Investigate it yourself. Jesus takes initiative in pushing his people to face their doubts. Doubts that, in order that their doubts would not be the last word for them. In order that their doubts not be things that gradually grow up as a cancer within them and take over more of their conscious awareness. He wanted Thomas to take his doubts seriously, to face it, to deal with it. And like Peter, he would believe, and after a time, have his belief confirmed in his own experience. We don't know that much about what happened to Thomas, but we know a little bit, and it's a very solid commitment to Christ. And I think we know without super reliable information that all the 12 were martyred. And willing to give up their life for faith in Christ by the end. So I'll stop there, and I've gone over a lot of material here. So over to you. For those of you who haven't been here before, we have a discussion after the lectures, which can go on for quite a while. So if anyone needs to go, feel free to just take off. That's fine. You won't be offending anybody or upsetting anybody. But we will stay here till people are, as long as people are interested in raising questions or adding to the material. Anybody? Yes.
So, do you think that all would fall away or fall away from some sort of doubt? So, right now you just have them leaving. Are all of them leaving because of doubt, or are there other reasons?
Depends, I guess. What we mean. I guess I'm using doubt pretty widely.
Okay.
There could be all sorts of reasons. I mean, they may have left the stove on at home,
yeah.
and had to go and fix it, or something. But the implication you have here is people were following him who said, "I'm not going to follow him anymore." And I think a huge range of reasons. I'm just taking what I just took was what I see suggested in that chapter itself. But it could be vast. It could be. I mean, today, for example, when I first went to Libri in the 1960s, the big issues of doubt and discussion were in epistemology. How can you know this is true? When do you have enough evidence to know that this is true? Can you have real knowledge of God and have it in human language? Issues like that. Now, I would say many of the issues of difficulty are to do with Christian ethics. How can I want to live with these ethical standards that the Bible tells me I should have, and I don't like them, or I think I'm more moral than God. As I read the Bible, I'm more moral than He is. So I think this, but just there's everything all the time. But I think that the shift is has been in that way over years.
So a bit more concrete, like so, the Venus, for example, is not necessarily someone who doubts or I mean, work with that. Or say I'm thinking of, you know, obviously Thomas is doubting, but is Judas doubting, for example, or is that or we put that in a different category, or does that all cover a whole host of things?
I think it does. I mean, someone who's just a hedonist. We're talking about here who were with people who were with Jesus and leave Jesus. Now, someone who's just been a hedonist who never heard of Jesus, you don't call that a doubt. But his faith is in a hedonistic framework, so he has a faith, and he's got someone he follows or something he follows. Judas, yes, I would say very much. And actually, in this chapter, he's dealing with Judas and how he he's among us, but he's not one of us. And it's hard to know what's going on in Judas' mind. Enormous numbers of people have tried to deal with Judas more charitably than the New Testament does. Most people who recreate a narrative about Judas want to justify him in some way, in that he never intended to betray Jesus to death, but just betrayed him to the Jewish authorities so that he would then bring in the kingdom of God then rather than waiting. In other words, that would push Jesus to do what he promised doing right away because he was impatient and thought that Jesus himself needed a push to bring down the kingdom, bring in the kingdom into it. So, I mean, there's all sorts of things that, and we don't really know much. We do know that he was pretty committed to stealing money from the common purse, and that was a big thing for him. It's hard to know how much his willingness to betray Jesus had to do with a different agenda for Israel. I just don't think we have much to go on there. But it certainly is doubting the truth of what Jesus was saying himself, doubting the way Jesus was presenting himself, doubting the value of following Jesus as the others were. So, yeah, I don't know if that gets at what you're saying or not. Okay. Yeah.
No, it says he was a thief.
That's right. Yeah.
Because he was in it from ready to get.
Yeah. And yet, very probably, that's not all that one could say about him. He was probably a very complicated character. So, I'd rather back off and say that that is something we can say. Yeah. Any other things we'd like? Yeah. Yeah.
You talked about of the maybe commitment to believe, but then over time coming to know through, like when you're talking about Peter experiences of miracles and things like that. Sometimes I have trouble with this because if someone asks me, like, why do you continue in your faith, I can speak to certain maybe ideas and reasons why it makes sense, but then also some experiences of seeing God come through or, encountering God in some way. But then some people I talk to or know about, they cannot say that. Mm-hmm. Up to this point in their life, they talk about maybe asking God to show himself and not ever experiencing him.
Yeah.
And they can't speak to these experiences or encounters. And so for them, they don't, even if they want to believe, they don't feel like they have that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I was just wondering if you were in conversation with someone just talking and saying those things, what would be your response?
Yeah, that's a very good issue, because I think that's true of quite a few people. Whether that is the truth of their lives or whether that's what they feel, or the way they think they experience it, is a big question, because many Christians who expect, say, and are taught to get that you can have health and wealth if you just do bup, 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 and don't get it, think God has let them down. God hasn't let them down. They were never promised what they were after. I think one has to have a very wide perspective on what God's work is going to be in us. And people certainly get incredibly different tracks in life and have different kinds of experiences of being let down by other Christians, by being praying like mad for something that doesn't happen, or that the reverse happens, or something like that. I mean, that's happening. And now, you have people living that way, and also not saying, God abandoned me, but seeing the hand of God nonetheless. And, I mean, you think of St. John of the Cross, Dark Night of the Soul, and in talking about how you can get so down and so discouraged that you, every way you had ever tried to connect with God gets kicked back in your face, and you have no grasp of anything. And he's saying, actually, God is taking you to a place that you would never get otherwise through that. That's terrifying to say, and that's, I think, I have never dared tell that to someone because I've never thought I had that knowledge. But I know that does happen, and I think that's what the sort of faith we're called to is that to know that God is with us and standing with us even through disappointment, even through difficulty. And you're absolutely right. It's not as if everyone has a nice inclined plane, sort of like a well-designed wheelchair ramp. Going like this of growth and prosperity. I mean, that's never promised. But the huge issue is I mean, Peter himself had some rough times too, as we know, and as did all sorts of people in the scriptures themselves. The issue there is not so much doubt or not, but is do you have evidence of the work of God in your life that you can point to and say, yes, he is alive and he has worked in my life, even though I may have failed at this and failed at that and blown the other thing and wound up in jail, whatever. And I find there are Christians who will say, yes, I've seen the work of God in my life, despite all the disappointments that I've come across, despite all the struggles and failures that I've been through. And that's totally not something someone else can lay on you. Because that just comes across as buck up. Don't just see that God is there. You just don't see how, but that's something someone has to really work through for themselves and conclude for themselves. Yeah. So I've often wondered, and some of my students ask, what promise in the Bible is promised to every Christian? And so we can be sure of, for me. And that's quite hard, because there's all sorts of promises which are actually in the Bible much more specific than we usually take them to be. We grab the ones we like and say, yes, this is for me. Mm-hmm. And that's okay some of the time, but not okay some of the other time. I think one of the sort of promises we have that will apply to everyone, that does apply to everyone who's a child of God, is, for example, that we will be able to bear fruit to him and to his kingdom. Everybody. That fruit will look totally different from one person to another. But think of someone who is a quadriplegic and spends basically their life in bed. Not exactly what anyone had planned. But I read Jesus and I read the first will be last and the last will be first. And I think, whoa, it may be that sort of person is a hero at the level of what none of us could have imagined. What that means, the first will be last and the last will be first, is that the basic scorekeepers of our society are going to be shown to have it completely wrong. The People magazine, the Sports Illustrated, the Fortune magazine, the Wall Street Journal, whatever Hollywood rag, they won't just miss the mark, they're going to have it really, really wrong. And so in the sight of God, it may be that the faith of someone who lives basically his life in a, or her life as a quadriplegic may be way out of sight from the rest of us in terms of closeness to God and facing things that are, and triumphs of faith over doubt and so on that, that the rest of us haven't even tackled. Because, I mean, you have to say, I mean, it's a really messy world and all this stuff can happen, and it's not that this doesn't ever happen to nice people. Yeah. I don't know what it's to be able to say what Peter said, you have to have a vision to see the hand of God in whatever your life, the shape of your life is. And that's a huge challenge, which I think many people don't have. It doesn't come to them immediately. It may take them years to see what the, where the hand of God is. But they need help, and yes.
I think that sounds different than you said. I want to understand it a little better. And it speaks to the whole knowing as opposed to believing, so you can kind of put those in opposition. You said that you, I think you said, that you don't know if you would have made it to into Christ if you couldn't see the truth in God. Am I restating what you said?
Say that again. Say what I said again.
You have come to commitment to commitment to Christ if you could not see the truth in it.
That's right.
There are cultures in the world where truth has nothing to do with life. It's all about honor and shame. And many of those come to Christ through personal experience with God, with Jesus in between. So I think it's possible, only in our culture we kind of come through, the whole truth-lie sort of paradigm. So I just wanted to challenge that a little bit because I think that knowing is a personal knowing.
Mm-hmm.
It's experiential knowing in that way, where people experience him. And then the promise that we all have is that he will always be with us. So that also speaks to that.
Yeah.
Personal nature. My husband was an agnostic and often would say people want to not have a personal relationship with God, but they want to have the same personal relationship that they have. Well,
of course.
That's not possible because one to another we are different. So, and then the other question.
I can only keep one question in my head at a time.
Okay.
But I'll lose. Wait, I agree with you. I see, what I didn't talk about is what could ever lead you to a commitment that is true. I think people are unbelievably afraid. Very few people are so hung up as I was in approaching God and doing it in such a head-trippy way as I did. For whatever reason, never mind. You can reach... I know some people who come to believe that the Christian faith is true by seeing love in another Christian in a way that just blows them sideways, and they believe it's true and they're willing to stand out in ways that shame me. Okay? So how we reach the place of it being true is just the sky's the limit in terms of different ways, different paths to believing it's true. Some are very cognitive, some are very experiential, some are very, whatever. Aesthetic. So I just couldn't get there at all, but I agree very much with what you're saying, because there's so many different paths to it. But still, if someone is a Christian, they believe it's true and are willing to deal with the tough side of that, meaning that it may require them to take a stand against something and are willing to do it. So, that's an important thing, because otherwise, what I said, you could take to be the real way to become a Christian is through a very head trippy kind of a process of Christian apologetics. That's totally not true. that doesn't happen very often. Thank you. So, sorry, you had another thing.
My second question was: did Dick join the rabbit?
That's a very big question. He ended up in Bush 2's cabinet. as the Office of Management and Budget under Bush 2. Or Bush 1, rather. Bush 1, sorry. He was in the Reagan White House with the office next to Reagan, controlling all the information getting to Reagan. But so he did. Yeah, he grabbed the rat race, something awful. But I think, and I didn't. He died several years ago. And yet I have a hope that he found God before that, because he was asking. Well, yeah, one of the only people would be seeing him was his minister from the Episcopal Church in hospital as he was thinking. So I hope. But he didn't resist the rat race. He was in something awful. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable achiever, yeah.
I'd like to pick up on this truth thing again. You said, I believe you said, that in some sense you put truth above God.
I said it, and then we'll go on from there. Yeah.
You almost said that in some sense you put the seeking for truth above God, and you believe in Him because it's true.
I don't say seeking, but I'm saying what I want to be sure of is that I believe it because it's true, not for some lesser reason.
Right. Yeah. Okay? I resonate with you. I mean, I'm closer to the head trip than many.
But it doesn't need to be head trippy to believe it's true.
Okay. But what gives me comfort is Jesus, you know, said you got to worship God in spirit and in truth. And in the Psalms, you know, he talks about truth in the innermost being really important. You know, that's why we're willing to confront doubt. But what makes me uncomfortable, which has been, I've only got a small grip answer on this, is Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, the life. And Proverbs says, the beginning of wisdom and knowledge is the fear of the Lord. Like a relationship comes before truth. And yet, if I heard you correctly, and whether I heard you correctly or not, for me, the truth sometimes comes before the relationship.
Yeah, amen.
And it makes me uncomfortable. It makes me wonder if this is Greek influenced philosophy, that somehow I'm not getting the Hebrew view of the world.
Yeah, that's a really good point. What you're getting is the finitude of the time I have to lay out what I want to say, because I think it's impossible to finding, even if you do it in a very head trippy way, to find God without that quest being totally morally qualified, as opposed to just a question of cognitive maneuvers.
Does morally qualified mean a fear of the Lord?
Yes.
Absolutely.
And along the way, who does God reveal Himself to? Is those who would be willing to follow Him, those who are willing to bow. The knowledge of God is available to those who are willing to bow, rather than those who are going to thumb their nose at God. And so the whole process is inseparable, I would say.
Well, I'll put a little plug in here. There's a book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Making, where a guy goes after quality. You read it carefully, and there's a point when she says, he, quality, revealed himself to him. He actually personifies quality in a little short little place. He actually speaks of almost a personal relationship with quality.
And what are you saying about that?
Well, I'm saying that opens the, to hear a Greek, well, he actually challenged a lot of Greek thought himself in that book.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But to hear a guy say that in a quest for quality, it was one of the first grips on a relationship might come before truth. Because theoretically, I couldn't see it. I could read the proverb. I just don't get it. Mm-hmm. Why does the fear of the Lord come first? I just don't get it. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, I said, here's a Western modern scientific guy who got a relationship going. And then,
I want to say the two are completely inseparable.
They have to be.
Yeah.
They have to be.
It does, given who God is, given where we start. Is with the fall. We start with original sin, trying to make good on the promise of the devil to Adam and Eve, which is you will be like God, knowing good and evil. You will be autonomous. You'll be the lawmaker yourself. Mm-hmm. That's where we start. And so we've got to be able to, our quest for God, from whatever, whether it's aesthetic, whether it's logical, whether it's whatever, it's got to be somewhere along the line we've got to bow to our Creator, and if it's someone bigger than we are, greater than we are, that we have to bow to. And but that's going to be all in the midst of arguments that are convincing, unconvincing, people who stretch me and lead me toward the truth, experiences that happen to me, and so on. So I think it's futile to think we can do it on just cognitive grounds of just maneuvering different propositions. We totally need to be willing to fear God the whole way along. It's not just that you need this as the last step. We need it to really go toward God anywhere along the line. There has to be that willingness. So one of my professors, I don't have a chance to, I won't have time to spin this out, but he would say that epistemology is a subheading under ethics. Because all our knowledge is morally qualified. And whatever we know, everything we know is morally spun in some way, shape, or not. And there's nothing that we know that is outside of moral categories in a total sense of being neutral, objective, independent, and so on, and value neutral, value free. But that gets into also the bigger questions that I don't think we're going to have time to get up tonight. Yeah.
A couple places where Jesus really makes that very explicit, and I can't remember where this is, but where he says you cannot know the truth because you care what people think about you more than what God.
Yeah.
So you say, if you care what people think more than what God thinks, it's impossible for you to understand the truth. Mm-hmm. It's totally a moral thing, and a thing of where your loyalty is.
Yeah, and Jesus says both. He says, if you don't believe me, what I say, look at my works. So that's a sort of a more cognitive approach of look at observation through observation to see what it shows you. But then there's first it's in John 5, I think, where he says, you don't believe and you can't believe because you want glory from each other, not from the only God. And so he says, you can't possibly. Work as hard as you will, you'll never believe because you want glory for yourself. All the apologetics, all the hard wrestling, will never get you to God.
Paul says, I didn't speak with wise words of human understanding because I didn't want your faith to be based upon the words of men, mm-hmm. but upon the power of God.
Yeah.
So he talked it.
Yeah. Which didn't mean he never did powerful reasoning.
Of course, but he was very much.
That's right.
He was deliberately wanting, well, I think the words stand for themselves.
Yeah.
He said
it
works with the power of the Spirit.
Yeah.
So, whatever that means.
Yeah. That's right. It means it wasn't in his power.
Yeah.
Yeah,
anyway,
yes.
So, I guess what comes to mind for me more than just like this concept of like doubt on a salvific claim, like if someone's going to doubt into eternity or if they're going to believe in God, is more like the doubt that the believer faces. On like an hourly basis, especially if you're someone who deals with anxiety on a regular basis, because I feel like the reality for me now, where there's definitely been a period of time where doubt was like, I don't even know if this whole Jesus thing is real, I don't know if this is worth staking my life on, and now it's like, okay, I've chosen where my identity lies, like if my name is written on his hand, that's great, but in the hourly, in the sometimes it's hard to get through an hour without like doubting that God looks at me favorably or that I'm okay. And that sort of doubt is in light of also being a daughter of the King, but it completely steals my joy and like, and I no longer have freedom anymore. And so I know we're talking about a different type of doubt here. But I guess the reason I'm even bringing this up is because in this context, I guess I was wondering if you had any words to say about that kind of doubt and how, as a believer, you found some like really effective ways to like actively fight that apart from just telling yourself the truth again.
Yeah, that's a good thing to raise because we have doubts of all sorts of different shapes aimed at all sorts of different things. So doubting that God loves us and is interested in us are and so on. I don't have a quick answer, but I would, in a sense, apply the same principles that I've been talking about tonight. Let's listen to this voice that you have that comes at you every hour and see what is it actually saying. I'm not asking you to let it all down, not necessarily. But I think you need to think, where is this voice coming from? What exactly is it claiming? What is it telling you? When does it come at you? What time of day? What is its message? What does it attack within the Christian faith that you do know in your top of your head, out in one side of your head anyway? See if you can arm yourself better against it. I mean, Schaeffer's book, True Spirituality, is actually quite interesting with this. He says that the sort of essence of true spirituality is to be able to have a moment-by-moment sense of the radical love of God for you through Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Moment-by-moment.
Appropriating the finished work of Christ.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, that is a tall order. But I love the way he says it's moment-by-moment. It's not as if this is an experience you must have sometime, but it's living it and standing against the garbage that comes at you within each hour. And being able to parry that, stand against it, whatever it is. But it means really thinking of how can we block this? How can we displace it with something else? Because there'll be some way to. There may be a different side of God's truth. There may be, you want to know what part of God's truth this is attacking. What kind of His promises are being undermined for you? Or is it many things? Is it one thing? But I think it's worth looking at it, putting it on the table, and trying to get at it. Second. But yes, go ahead. You go ahead.
There
was a father of a demonized child said that.
But that's, even as we are not believing or having doubt, we can say that we believe.
That's right.
And ask, help me in my unbelief.
Yeah. The interesting thing there is that, I'm glad you raised that, he says, help my unbelief. Jesus treated him not as an unbeliever, but as a doubter. Mm-hmm. As someone who's halfway between. The man who said, I believe, help my unbelief. Because he can't believe that his son could be healed, so he didn't just take his unbelief side literally. He treated him as a doubter, as someone who has two voices in two minds.
Which is what
you're speaking of. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and it can happen in all sorts of different ways, over whether we think God has power to do something, or is going to do something, or whether we think God loves us or He's forgotten all about us. That's right. Yeah.
So the first introduction of the practice of jumping doubt, if you will, was the person in the garden, and Satan twists the words of God.
Mm-hmm.
And his methodology is virtually the same throughout the Word of God. He first will question it, and then he'll twist it, and he'll deny the truth of God. And in Luke 4, in the wilderness, the methodology against it is exemplified in how Jesus dealt with what was presented by him.
If you really are the Son of God.
Yeah.
If you, and so again, so to question.
You see the methodology of Satan, and you see the methodology of Christ refuting.
Yeah, he's inciting doubt. He tries to get under people's skin and get certainly. And you're right. It's the same. I actually lectured on this 2 weeks ago here, what Satan was doing in both places, in the garden and in the temptation of Jesus, was to aim at getting them to doubt God's commitment to them, Adam and Eve, to doubt their God's being a giver of all good things, but rather to think that God was a withholder of good things from them. No, he's not giving. Yeah, he's not going to give you what you really need and what's good for you. He's keeping that from you. And the Satan and the temptation of Jesus as well, as if you are the... So he's getting to doubt the sonship and the relatedness of God's commitment to us. That's true. Any other things, Rita? Yes, David.
I wonder, how would you define faith as sort of the antithesis to doubt? It seems like faith, I think sometimes faith is conflated with belief. So if you believe the propositional truths on the tracts, you'll be saved. Obviously, there's a relational aspect to faith. And yet, doubt affects both sort of the intellectual assent to certain truths and also relational aspects of one's faith. So is faith sort of the decision to trust even though you don't feel relationally close or see things intellectually, like the Lord help my unbelief?
Yeah. I think I can't remember when you came. I may have talked about this earlier in the lecture, but I've looked at faith as the medium position between belief and unbelief.
So it's
I'm sorry, doubt. Sorry. Thank you. What did I say? Anyway, what I meant to say was that doubt is in the middle position between faith and unbelief, and it's being in two minds, and so. It acts something of the way fear stands between courage and cowardice. So we're just two voices that can take us either way, either direction. I think it's faith and doubt and unbelief all have to do with the cognitive and also the relational and the emotional. Everything is all in there. None of it is rarefied in terms of one aspect of the human personality, but it's all mixed in. Frame your question for me again in the light of that, okay?
Yeah. So I'm just wondering how you sort of define faith in the presence of doubt, both intellectual and relational, like the Psalms are full of, God, why are you forsaken? Sort of questions. So it seems that you can have faith and habit,
yeah.
But you can go through doubt. So how is it that one has faith even in the midst of doubt?
Yeah, I think faith is a prior larger, and faith and belief, it's the same. They're just different English translations of the same Greek word in the New Testament. So there's no difference between faith and belief. I think it's that faith is a commitment of your a trust in God and a commitment of the direction of your life, and a receiving of a gift of salvation, which is it's the biggest picture of what. The whole way to understand your life. You then, I think, go through times when we have to question pieces of that, and sometimes we question the whole of it. But I'm trying to keep it from going all over the place here. But we. Our real hope in faith is that God has a hold of us. Our real hope in faith is a trust in God that He has a grip on us. And it isn't that we'll never doubt, we'll never sin, certainly, but there's a relational reality which is really a status change. It's like getting married, something happens in town hall. So the marriage license is filled out and is there, and two people are married, even though they may fight with each other, they may have disagreements with each other, they may sin against each other, but they're not unmarried. And in the same way, something legal happens, and like I talked 2 weeks ago about adoption. like a child is legally adopted. When they bust the windows at home, they're not unadopted. And so it's a trust. That's what faith is. That's the reality that one steps into. God is totally active in that and is holding us. Now, what I can't say is that if that's true, you will never feel this or that or something like that. Because this is true of you, you could never possibly experience something. No, you can experience almost anything at any one moment. But something is really real there that will hold you and that brings you back to it and that keeps you. So it isn't just faith versus doubt. It's faith and the whole relationship to God that faith takes you into, and the resting on grace that is the really the main thing there. So it's a whole relationship legally before God that is then attacked at a psychological level with us at different times, but we have to ride that and try and deal with that as it comes and goes. And of course, we Christians will have doubts as to, well, just to be heard, does God really love me or not? Is this all on or off? And we're liable to have doubts of just that sort. But that doesn't change the reality of what's there. Is that? I'm not sure I'm connecting with.
Yeah.
That. Yeah.
I wanted to know, kind of going off of this, I'm trying to extend. Do you believe that we can doubt our faith? Or is doubt always something that happens to belief? Because to me, I often struggle with that distinction. To me, faith is what keeps us in a state of belief, even when that belief is tested by doubt. I think that if we find ourselves doubting our faith, I don't know, it's a much harder thing for me to comprehend. I mean, when you doubt something, you're doubting your belief in that, you know, the truth of that. But in the midst of doubt, what allows you to actually doubt in the first place and kind of continue as a Christian through doubt is the existence of faith. Do we doubt our faith or do we doubt our beliefs?
I have a hard time making a distinction between them, actually.
The distinction that I hear you making is faith is a large, an overall faith in Jesus, in God, and your belief specific items.
I think that faith is something that we have. But then, obviously, as Christians, as believers, we have faith that kind of holds us, holds all of our beliefs together.
And so
we doubt belief within our Christian faith.
So the faith is this large thing, and beliefs are individual, smaller thing. Items.
Yeah, I mean, it's, right, faith pertains to our relationship to God, and, the acceptance of these individual beliefs. I think that our faith exists because we have come to a place of believing, but we also cannot believe without the faith. I feel like if I'm going through doubt and I'm doubting the things that I have come to believe, that faith is still allowing me, even through times of doubt, to wrestle with that doubt. And even if I don't resolve the doubt, I'm still a Christian. Right? At the end of the day, I'm still a believer, even though there are plenty of things that I doubt. Whereas if you doubt your faith, then to me that just seems to be a much, much bigger
I'm uncomfortable with having a main difference between faith and belief because the two are really biblically the same, but what if you say, if you make the distinction between faith and specific beliefs, which I think is the distinction you're making, specific convictions about different things, about how you should do this and do that, deal with your money, and how you should work, and what you believe about global warming or something like this, you have faith as the big picture, but you also have, which is made up of a zillion little beliefs about all sorts of different things. Then I agree with you that the big thing you can doubt that you've got one thing right. You can doubt that God really led me to this job. That's a small level belief, I think, that God leads us and guides us in this way. You can have doubts that He really has, like, and that can be make a crisis to you. It doesn't shake your ultimate faith that you're a Christian, but shakes the way you've seen the way your development.
What if you're legitimately doubting salvation? You know, many people struggle with even doubting their salvation. Are they really doubting their faith, or are they doubting their belief?
Well, again, I don't want to distinguish those words as pointing to two completely different things, okay? But what you're dealing with is it depends on why you're doubting your salvation. I mean, it may be the reason you doubt your salvation is you slipped up and did something you think no Christian should do, and that I think is likely to be a certain belief that's much smaller than the faith as a whole. On the other hand, if the reason you think you doubt your salvation is that you're saying, I really don't want to obey God. I know what I need to do, but I actually refuse to do it. I'm going to go do something else entirely in defiance to Him. Then you're doubting, or you're blocking the Lordship of God. And I would say you should be doubting your salvation. I'm not saying you're not a Christian, but you should be calling your salvation into question if you, over time, as a firm conviction and commitment, simply refuse to bow before Him in some area that is a significant area of your life, which means you may not be doubting the truth of the Christian faith, but you're doubting that you're a part of that, that you've really received Him, or maybe you have put Him on hold or something like that. So I think your doubt of your salvation can come from all sorts of different angles.
Right. I guess I'm always a little bit bothered when I hear people use the phraseology doubting their faith. I don't know. I guess you don't really think there is a distinction between belief and faith.
Well, there is a distinction that you make, though, but maybe not attached to those words. There's a distinction between the big picture of the whole of what the faith is and specific beliefs that you have in all these areas. Now, someone can say that they doubt their faith for either of those reasons, for specific small area ones or for the whole schmear.
Yes.
Someone can doubt their salvation for either. Yeah, Tom?
I think a good distinction between this. Someone might doubt their salvation to really, could almost be totally different reasons. One would be doubting the truth of the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
The other is not doubting the truth of the gospel, but doubting whether the person himself has
and received it.
Hooked on to God, mm-hmm. and have that personal relationship. You might doubt that,
mm-hmm.
without doubting the truth of the gospel.
Totally, yeah.
There's a possible distinction on that.
Yeah. Yes.
And kind of down that line, like, whenever you're trying to draw a line between, like, faith and belief, like, that's kind of what I was kind of envisioning. Well, just especially faith being in line with, like, James talking about, like faith without works is dead, just this aspect of faith that is very much like a commitment
aspect rather than just like a, like the thing that I'm thinking about like isn't true, instead of like my commitment isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of having trouble working that. But
well, I believe the Amplified Bible affirms the belief and faith are the same root word. But when it uses the word belief...
So is the Greek New Testament.
Yeah, the Greek, yeah. Right. I believe the Amplified Bible talks about belief, talks about trust, rely on, adhere to. It's not just a mental assent.
Gotcha.
And I think it's far more words than that. It's probably five or six or seven words. But trust, rely on, adhere to, depend upon, lean on, just this whole thing. And something that's curious is if you ask most Christians which gospel speaks most about faith, they'll say John. In the King James, the word faith doesn't appear once, but the verb to believe is all over that. It's all over the place. There seems to be this verb to believe and this the same root word faith being. And sometimes I find it useful to think of the belief as to believe as an action. Like that rely, adhere to, trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what you're getting at. There's a cognitive piece of what you just defined, and there's an emotional piece to what you just defined. And maybe that's what you're distinguishing between your cognitive belief in God, but your emotional inability to trust and bringing you doubt.
I wonder if it would be helpful to bring it into sort of real life circumstance as in being adopted as a child of God, maybe the previous example of the prodigal, believed enough in his father's enduring love that he was at least fed. And he could see that, if he couldn't believe in anything else. Is that his word?
I think the few points that have been made, there is like the cognitive, which and when I look at, you know, so often the pursuit of truth, it's maybe there isn't a difference between, you know, faith and belief technically, but in the way it's kind of I've always seen it, it's much easier to believe something to be true on the cognitive level, and then faith is when you take that belief and do something with it.
Yeah.
And faith is much harder to really define, you know, where what is different. Like, I mean, I believe in this, so, you know, right, like, well, or even if you are doing something about it, like, even if you are, you know, living as a Christian, that's why when people say, like, oh, you know, I'm doubting either my belief or I'm doubting my faith, are they saying the same thing or is it different? Because to me, it seems different. It seems like, well, even if I believe or think I believe all these things, there can still be this lingering doubt about this faith element that is so often far more difficult to really define in, you know, in your life as a practicing Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
It's just that there's one Greek word that's translated by those two English words.
Okay.
And you're and again, Paul uses that word somewhat differently than James. So you have to look at context, and I think you have the complexity of the whole act of belief and faith, which is everything you've loaded onto it. It's the full range of big picture, small picture, cognitive, utter commitment and trust. All that is loaded into the whole of it. And all those distinctions are there, but I don't think the distinctions are, at least in the Bible, between those two words. So we need to respect the different sides, the different angles of what you're saying. And as you say, with faith, our faith, we have a big picture that we can hold on to something. And which isn't threatened as we have difficulties with certain beliefs and difficulties we get into on a smaller level.
I mean, yes, you made it clear earlier.
Yeah, let's
I'm just seeing a distinction emerge between the subjective and the objective, which kind of, for me at least, makes a distinction between faith and belief. And I know that you're trying to really get away from, like, talking about this distinction, but you say, I believe. It's a very personal thing, and it's also a verb. Whereas you have faith, or you're part of a faith community, or the community of faith. So that's, I think, on a more objective level. So when I think of doubt as it relates to belief, I think of it as a personal connection, whereas if I have doubt about the faith, it's almost as synonymous as with the gospel, as with the structure of belief, of faith that I have bought into.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's helpful at all, the objective versus the subject.
Or even it doesn't have to be between faith and belief. I mean, how about just faith and truth? Mm-hmm. It's easy to doubt truth. I mean, most of the time we doubt it's about what is true. But I don't know. Are doubting, when you doubt truth, are you doubting faith? I think there is a distinction there.
Sure. There's a distinction. I mean, truth is, well, none of them are you allowed to say one is all objective, one is all subjective, or one is all just cognitive and the other is
right.
Volitional and commitment and so on. Because the truth, you do the truth. You don't just believe the truth, but you do the truth. And there's all sorts of differences, as you say, between the objective things that you can write in terms of propositions on a blackboard, and the complexity and gravity of the sort of commitments we get into, and trust, acts of trust we get into in living out the gospel. So I just don't want to think we've solved the problem when we can separate two different words. We've got a very complicated thing going where, as you say, we often doubt the truth issues, but we've heard tonight that we also doubt just whether God loves me every hour.
It's just not so cut and dry. It's not so black and white. We can believe the truth and not doubt the truth. But with faith, you know, we obviously do my commandments, or, you know, there's this constant struggle as sinners,
mm-hmm.
where as we look at truth and we are told to, you know, to do these things or not do these things, and that we will know our faith by our obedience, and as we don't obey, then it's really, we end up looking and saying, well, I believe these things, but based on life, do you doubt your faith in these things, because I'm not even talking a complete absence of obedience. I mean, just the normal day-to-day life of a Christian,
mm-hmm.
that is often still mired in many of the mistakes and sins that will continue to plague us as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because we don't have, is our faith not real? You know, I believe these things, but they're not all happening. So am I doubting my faith, or am I doubting their truth? Because very often, I, at least in my own mind, feel that I'm doing two different things. I know when I'm doubting that something is true, but if something is true. And usually it's a smaller issue. And those things can affect your faith if that issue becomes so big that you're realizing it's kind of affecting the big picture. But your faith is really something that you doubt when you look at life and, you know, your actions and how it measures up to the truth that you believed in, and realize that there's this contradiction that may suggest that you lack faith,
or more often that you fail to apply your faith in this situation yesterday, and you fail to respond in gratitude to God and out of obedience to God because you're a sinner and you're a human being, and you messed up. And that's within faith, within, you know, we lay hold of all sorts of resources that we have to in terms of the help of the Holy Spirit, the knowledge of the Scriptures, the power of Christ with us. But then we don't take advantage of those things some of the time. So they're all there. Our relationship to God is still in place, but we don't draw on the strength that we've got, that we have available to us, and we fail. But then the thing is, what do we do? Do we just collapse in despair and say, I'm not a Christian at all? Or do we say, hey, this is fairly standard procedure for screwed up people like all of us are? And so I don't want to encourage people to get hung up on rightly defining and understanding exactly what goes on, I think, because this is what it is to be human. This is a train going fast. We're screwing up all over the place each day, and we need to draw on all the strength we can from God, pray for the power of the Holy Spirit to transform us, get what help we can from other people, and go forward. And it's not going to be resolved by a fine-tuned definitional adjustment in the doctrine of sanctification, I don't think. It's going to be resolved by learning as we go, how are we likely to fail, how have we failed before, what are the setting sins that we fall into all the time, and trying to have victory over them.
But all in the context of, I think, just the context of that we are God's adopted children by grace, and we can't fall out of that. And Jesus said, my sheep hear my voice, they hear me, they follow me, none can pluck them out of my hand. And if that's the overall faith, then we know, you know, children who are adopted have disobeyed their parents sometimes, and in fact, you know, ignore their parents sometimes, and yet it doesn't mean they're not a child.
Right, but the Bible also says that, you know, say the son, I never knew you. So there are plenty of people that walk around calling themselves adopted children.
But that's a really interesting passage. That's a really key passage, because it's the person that Jesus said that to, is the person that came before God with his resume.
Right.
And said, I've done this in your name, I've done this in your name. Look at all the great things I've done. And Jesus said, depart from it, I never knew you, because he didn't come with empty hands. Hey, he didn't come saying, you know, it's a publican, it was a sinner who's on the ground saying, Lord, have mercy, I can't even look at you, I'm a sinner. That Jesus said, went home justified. And that's our only hope. The only hope that we're a child of God is that we've come to him with empty hands and received this incredible gift of adoption, of salvation.
That was the point of salvation, though. You know, kind of living salvation. I mean, there are plenty of Christians who kind of combine the faith, you know, upon salvation, come before the Lord with empty hands, but then throughout their walk, maybe live more like Republican or Republican, right?
Paul's letter to the Galatians, the whole message of Galatians was, we started with this faith, this empty hands kind of faith, recognizing that Jesus and the cross is the only thing that saved you.
Yeah.
What happened to that? Now you've added all these. You've added all these rules and regulations. You've basically lost it, because you're adding things. You're adding your hope in being able to obey God's law.
Okay. Any other issues people would like to raise? I'm not sure we're gaining on this one. Yeah.
I just wanted to go back to what you were saying about the relationship between marriage or between us and God. That it exists and it's intact and it's legal, even though there might be problems in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it was the perfect response to the question about the psalmist feeling as I have forsaken him or living hope. The psalmist is going to God and is staying in relationship and expressing the concerns.
Even though he's got lots of grievances and shakes his fist at God.
And growing and growing, but it's not static.
Mm-hmm.
But the relationship is intact.
Yeah, that's right.
Distance in a relationship doesn't mean the absence of a relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I'm
one minor note. I'm a little curious, because in Christian circles, people often share that they're like struggling with something, or they have misgivings, or they're uncertain. Are those just other words for doubt? Would you consider those under the rubrics of doubt? Is there a scale of doubt?
The problem is, it's a free country, and people can define these words as they like. What were your struggle?
Avoid this scary term, because doubt kind of implies the loss of faith.
It could be, but it wouldn't need to be. I mean, you could have all sorts of struggles without those struggles having to do with doubt. You could have just struggles of being able to do something that you knew you would need to do. You know God wants you to do it, but you have trouble doing it. You have struggles with a relationship. The problem is more out of your control, and you're trying to deal with your end of it, but it's always difficult to try and make it work. So I think there's a lot of words that we can use that are hardship words, let's say, that aren't actually doubt. But you're right, anything can be used as a euphemism for doubt.
Right. Do you perceive doubt as an inevitable component in the life, in the spiritual life?
Well, I see doubt as normal. As I said along the way, I know two people who claim to have never doubted that I believe. The rest of them, I've heard, I don't believe. One of them was actually Mrs. Schaefer, Edith Schaefer, who said she never doubted, and I believe her, because I really knew her well. And
Francis Schaefer never made that claim.
He would never dream of making that claim.
He
struggles all over the place. So I think it's very unusual if someone doesn't doubt, hasn't had doubts. Mm-hmm. It's possible that if they claim that, they just don't realize they did. But I think the vast majority of people don't have that level of certainty of that's with them all the time. Because it's not just certainty, but it's certainty that sticks with you up and down and backwards and forwards and in the middle of the night when you get up and you're sick and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So it's a tall order. And I think we it's far better to just expect it, not welcome it, but expect it and not be freaked out when it comes. I mean, I didn't get into this really, but my own experience is that my first doubts, having just become a Christian, again, I just finished college in the year after that, and my uncle was an Episcopal minister, and he made it a project to try and destroy this fundamentalist faith that his nephew had gotten connected with somehow by some fantastic mistake. And so he threw all sorts of garbage at me about the Bible and how you couldn't possibly believe it and so forth. And the first few things he said, I thought, good grief, I have no idea how to answer this guy. And I just sort of felt, I'd take everything of my faith and just throw it up like a bunch of papers in the air and throw it down, because it's all is lost. I bought into a bill of goods and it's just all over because I was stupid and whatever. And then I actually go and look at the charges that he did, and I think, good grief. He didn't read further in the passage, or he didn't know what he was doing. He was just throwing mud at the Bible. And there was perfectly good answers to the things he had. But that happened to me again and again and again. And I began to, when I doubted, say, okay, I've been here before. Where did I go last time? Rather than saying, help, all is lost. You know, so doubt becomes not an old friend, but an old acquaintance. Especially if you have doubts that keep, of different sorts, but they keep coming back at you. So I think each of us has different kinds of doubts that get to us and that bother us more or less than others. Somehow, I don't have an all is lost response to doubt anymore.
Can I just mention, for me, one of the sources of doubt, I became a Christian when I was 16, and not from a Christian family, but one of the sources of doubt has not been so much doubting the whole reality of the Christian worldview, but rather doubting the goodness of God in light of, say, just horrible things you hear on the news, and suffering children, and awful things happening, and different parts of the world, and so the, in fact, it's interesting because the passage that Dick had, you know, I did a lecture here. I've done a couple of lectures on the problem of evil in summary because it was a good way for me to try to tackle it for myself. What, you know, how, what do I do with these doubts about the goodness of God? And actually, that text that, that Dick had up was one of the ones that's most helpful to me. It's thinking, as Peter saying, "To whom shall I go, Lord? You have the words of eternal life." And thinking, I need to look at other. Everybody that lives in this world lives in a really broken, screwed up world where there's all sorts of horrible things that happen, unjust things. What are the options? What are the different ways of different worldviews look at suffering? You know, Christian Science says it's an illusion. It really isn't there. Everything's really fine. Well, I can't live with that. Buddhism says this, something else says this, and then there's just all the, you know, basically the modern. The probably most common thing today is distraction. Don't think about it. And if it stops affecting you, don't think about it. But I found that really helpful, just to say, okay, there's a problem. Christianity is a problem of evil, of suffering, of pain. And how can there be a good, all-powerful God in a world where there's so much crap that happens? But you know, everybody has that problem. I mean, everybody has the problem of living in a world and trying to make sense. So just looking at different alternatives, and I thought I went back to that Peter passage and ended up coming around after I was doing a lot of studying and looking at different alternatives and saying, Lord, I think you're the one with the Christian worldview. Jesus does have the word of eternal life. There's a good creation that's gone bad, but there's redemption, and just the biblical worldview seems to deal with the reality of the suffering. Not a nice little simple package answer, but nobody has a nice little simple package answer. And the cross seemed to be the place where God's goodness and justice and the reality of evil come together in a way that's, you know, facing those realities. So that's been for me a place of where I've doubted not the whole thing, but the goodness of God. And that's it.
And that's an issue that's liable to come back at us again and again and again in our lives as we confront actual evil in ourselves and what may come at us.
Yeah,
Tom.
Speaking of where else we could go, I believe you made the statement that if you turn away from Jesus, by definition, you're selecting something else, whether you know it or not. Isn't there a stance that says, okay, this isn't working, I'm rejecting it, I'm back to seeking mode? Think of the disciples before Jesus and before John the Baptist. I'm not so sure they were hard after anybody. Mm-hmm. And they were probably like, the priests aren't working, we're outcast.
We don't know, yeah.
We don't know, but I don't have a sense that they were jumping. I mean, one was a zealot, one was whatever, but tax collector didn't look to me like he was particularly, Matthew didn't look like he was particularly doing anything but distracting himself.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me, as a scientist, as a guy who does our research and development, I face a new problem, saying, yikes, prevailing theories aren't working, scrap them, you go back to observation mode.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a kind of agnosticism. I sort of distinguish between a hardcore agnosticism, which is saying ultimate truth cannot be known, which to me is a sort of self-refuting kind of a thing, because you've just said an ultimate truth. But you can have what I would call an open agnosticism, which says, I haven't seen anything yet that convinces me, but I'm looking. But that person then, if they're honest, is open to look at, to look for whatever's there.
Right, and they haven't made it. They're not necessarily sure. They haven't gone somewhere else. They've gone back to square one and said, okay, I've got to sort this out.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is that we don't stay there long.
Okay, that's fine.
We tend to... Well, even that would be a generalization that might be unfair. But it's a really... what we usually do is to find some idle system... that will distract
that
us.
Faith in self?
Well, but
faith in truth.
It depends. if your faith in yourself is in your own mind is up for grabs because you're open to look at all options. In other words, so your faith in yourself isn't keeping you, isn't closing certain options for you.
Right.
Because in a sense, we all live inside our own heads. We've got no other place to live. And so I know it's a terrible shame, but that's the fact of it. We've got to start inside our own heads. The question is, what conditions do we have for our search from inside our heads? There is a way of saying, listen, I have not met anything that convinces me that it's true, but so where can I look? Who can I listen to? Who can I read? Who can I understand? Who can I see, talk to, whatever? Which to me is a more honest agnosticism than saying ultimate truth is unknowable. And it's very hard to keep honest and stay honest. I mean, a lot of people will search very hard within a certain narrow closed system of possibilities, but not outside those. Someone talked about, wrote about, or spoke about Albert Camus, who was a tremendous searcher for the truth, searcher for freedom, searcher for the truth. So he pointed out, but he had, for much of his life at least, a very narrow highway in which that search took place. And repentance was not included in what was a possibility in terms of saying, I've got it wrong, I've really made a mistake, I bear responsibility for some of this mess, was not really in the scope of his 360 degrees that was open for investigation. So I think a lot of people will search very hard, but with very real strictures on where they're willing to search or where they're willing to find anything. And so that's where what Tom is saying is right, but it's a tremendous challenge, I think, for someone to be really honest there and not close doors and search in certain areas or to their favorite areas or whatever. Someone who's willing to at least claim to be open, that's worth taking seriously and taking them at their word as far as we can. Anything else? Yeah. You have, okay. You want, watch out in an auction. You may buy something. Okay, well, let's call it a night, and thanks for your patience.
Yeah.